Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Andy, Don, and Dude.
Now put your hands in the air, wave them like you just don't care. It's the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got it. I got Andy and Don with me. Gentlemen, you guys ready to do some hipping and hopping here on the podcast today?
Doing good, buddy. Ready to get the hippities and the hops on here.
Wow, that's so in the spirit of 80s hip-hop and how uncool we are and how cool it is. Don, how about you?
Well, I'd like you to refer to me by my new hip-hop name, Don Amatapia.
Wow.
You might want to explain what onomatopoeia is in order for that to make sense.
Oh, that's those are words that sound, that describe a sound or sound like what they're describing, I guess. Mm. Like boom, bang, all the Batman things from the old TV show.
Yeah. It's onomatopoeia.
So when you're rapping, you're like, that sounds like someone should be rapping? Is that kind of what you're implying?
Yeah, he's just emulating the sounds of it. He's going rap, 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 and he rap. All right, so this is the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums and the album format. We have a great show for you this week. We're going to be talking about some classic 80s hip-hop albums. We'll each be picking one and bringing it up for discussion. Don's going to ask us a deep question. We're going to have some shout-outs to some other albums and album-related items we're digging, and then we're going to spin the wheel of musical discovery to find out what we'll be talking about next time. But this week, it's hip-hop.
That's what I'm talking about!
Well, the 1980s were a pivotal era in hip-hop, characterized by groundbreaking albums that shaped the genre's identity. Iconic releases not only showcased innovative production and lyricism, but also addressed social issues, setting the stage for the future. This decade laid the foundation for hip-hop's evolution, influencing countless musicians and establishing it as a dominant cultural force. And today, each of us will present hip-hop albums from the 1980s.
Yeah, so hip-hop of the 80s for me was about fun and breakdancing in the early stages of it. It continued to be party music, but it started to get a little more serious throughout the course of the 80s. And I think we've done a pretty good job of picking albums that find that balance. As always, when we get deep into the weeds on hip-hop, we like to...
De La Soul.
We like to call Soul.
Hey guys, Saul back again to talk about some of my favorite albums. This time, we're going to the 1980s to talk about my top 5 hip-hop albums of the decade. First, I'll go to the West Coast with N.W.A.'s Straight Outta Compton. This album still hits today and was an introduction to some of rap's most influential players, most notably the lyrical prowess of Ice Cube and the beats of super producer Dr. Dre. Next, we'll swing back east for Public Enemy's It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. This album is filled with protest songs, hard beats, and powerful lyrics. Next, we head over to Hollis Queens for Run-DMC. Picking just one Run-DMC album was tough, but I settled on Raisin' Hell because it really is the album that broke them out, and they were the reigning kings of rap at that time. It also includes one of my all-time favorite party records, Peter Piper. Next, we hit up the Bronx, and again, this was tough picking just one album from this artist, but I chose Criminal Minded by Boogie Down Productions because it features two songs that were part of one of the original hip-hop beefs. The Bridge Is Over is a clapback to Queens rapper MC Shan and was the final blow in the battle. Finally, I have to go with Eric B. and Rakim's Paid in Full. Their debut album introduced the world to the all-time GOAT lyricist Rakim and DJ Eric B., his partner in crime. Eric B. for president.
Thank you, Saul. I mean, it's great to get that information and his opinions on the top five, but I also felt like I was being seduced at the same time. So maybe I'm falling in love with Saul and these albums all at the same time. What'd you guys think of that list?
Yeah, it was, it seems like a good list to me. I was surprised not to see De La Soul on there, 3 feet high and rising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on a top 10, it would have been there. But yeah, five's tough. There's a lot of music, a lot of hip hop in that era. Andy, how about you? What'd you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think a few of those probably on my list too. We've covered, or at least talked about a handful of those on the show in the past. Mm-hmm. Raising Hell would have been a good one for this episode, I think.
Yeah.
I was close to picking that one. But yeah, I'll vote for Rakim. I think if he's got the nomination, sure.
All right. Well, thank you once again, Saul, for your choices. Why don't we get into ours?
You choose me?
All right. For my 80s hip-hop selection, we are talking about Dana Dane and his 1987 album, Dana Dane with Fame. It just rolls out the tongue.
Yes.
Gotta love it. This was the debut studio album for the Brooklyn, New York MC born Dana McLeese. Peaked at number 46 on the charts. I think this is the debut single, Cinderfella, Dana Dane. Guy's great with branding. I live in a house with my crew stepdad
and two stepbrothers who treated me bad. I cook, I clean. Hello, Dana. Hello, Governor.
From Brooklyn, not London, surprisingly. So that track there peaked at number 11 on the R&B chart. Yeah, I was just kind of taken by his goofy persona, I guess I would say. He's a bit of a character, and this album is pretty entertaining. My clickbait headline is, "Gather round, kids, for Dana Dane's hip-hop story hour, filled with sexy princesses, sexy doctors, and even sexy robbers."
Wow. Yeah, it sounds like a Halloween party.
Sexy Halloween party. Yeah, I just love the world this guy's created, man. It's everything in it is just kind of funny, and it's like a cartoon a little bit.
Yeah, it kind of mirrors some of that goofy style that like Fresh Prince and DJ Jazzy Jeff were doing at the same around the same time. Similar yeah. beats, similar kind of sing-songy storytelling with humor, and they're yep. doing voices like, you know, Will Smith doing his mom's voice and yeah. Dana Dane doing the voice of a young lady he was out with who started speaking mm-hmm. Japanese.
Right. Yeah. I think there's something really funny about that. As a rapper just slips into these different characters mm-hmm. throughout a song. It makes for some compelling storytelling. Why don't we jump in and hear one of those songs that really leans into the storytelling? This was pretty popular back in the late 80s. It's called Nightmares. Nightmares of the night.
Those singers could give you nightmares.
Yeah. Love that echo effect
yeah.
in there. I actually have history with this song. You guys remember I told you I shoplifted this power rap compilation from Caldor?
Yeah.
Yeah, this song was actually on there. So it's like, oh, I remember this guy. Yeah. So it's an amusing song. It features Dane basically visiting a psychiatrist and explaining these horrible nightmares he's having that are basically about horrific dates, you know, with ugly women. Yeah. It's pretty mean. So the one girl is Anita the Beast.
Right.
And then wow. I think the psychiatrist doesn't unveil her face until the end, and I think it turns out to be Anita the Beast. Mm-hmm. So it's a living nightmare. Actually incorporates a sample of the theme song from the Munsters.
Mm.
So kind of like, yeah, we got Halloween coming up. This is kind of a Halloween-themed rap song. Paving yep. the way for Nightmare on My Street by DJ Jazzy Jeff there and the Fresh Prince.
Yeah.
All right, so my clickbait headline for the Dana Dane record is, "As Hip-Hop Gets Serious, Dana Dane Shows Us the Funny." So it's definitely a unique album in this era, or at least I think it is.
Wait, first, Shows Us the Funny, was that a Show Me the Money reference?
Yes.
You're trying to emulate Dana Dane with clever, humorous. All right, gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Shows Us the Funny. Yeah.
It seems like it's very Bob Saget of you.
Yeah. So, you know, as Andy already said, you know, just amusing storytelling, lightweight and often funny. I'm not sure if this is the right expression, but it feels like a little more street, like the Fresh Prince. Like, even though I think the Fresh Prince was also from like inner city right. Philadelphia or something, it still sort of felt suburban to me or something.
Parents just don't understand. I think I put a mindset in our brains that he was
yeah.
living with his mom and dad and that he was like a teenager or something. And this is a little more adult themes, I guess.
Yeah, on that spectrum, I guess this is a little bit more, but I wouldn't say it's quite NWA or anything.
No. Yeah, and that's, I mean, I guess that's why it stands out is just, I mean, compared to an NWA record, you know, it's just, it's something completely different. And that's good. I mean, you need the lighter side of things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his English affect, I guess, is kind of interesting. Yeah. But, I mean, he was part of, like, Slick Rick's crew. I forget what they're called. Mm-hmm. Kango crew or something, I think they were called. Mm-hmm. But Slick Rick actually is English. So I don't know if he's mocking him or
no. I think what I read was that he, you know, had heard some like reggae and Jamaican music and loved the accents and thought that using some kind of accent would help him to rhyme differently and be able to use different words together because of the change in pronunciation. So yeah,
I mean it does. It sounds goofy at first, but you get used to it pretty quickly after a few moments.
So I mean It's an amusing listen, and, you know, I think it has its place, you know, in history, but it's probably not something I'll revisit very often, and I wouldn't point to it as one of the great records of the golden age of hip-hop, but it's, you know, it's fun and unique.
Yeah, I would totally agree. I think it's an interesting little landmark in the history of 80s hip-hop, and the record was produced by Herbie Lovebug.
Oh, yeah.
Also was involved with Salt and Pepper and Kid and Play.
Cool.
Why don't we hear another track here? This is one he's featured on called This Be the Death Beat.
This Be the Death Beat is this camp name. Now do me a favor for me and my team. When I say scream, would you please scream? Scream!
Wow. Yeah, that dates it pretty quickly.
I like how he said please. That was very British of him.
That's the British, sorry.
He's the polite rapper.
Right.
So that song is lyrically about showing confidence and style. You know, I'm Dana Dane and I'm back again, announcing himself throughout the record. You know, it's got his name on the title, his name throughout the tracks.
Most of the songs. Yes.
The rhymes are slick and the flow is super laid back, which makes it nice. He's just casually telling a story. It's like he's just sitting back in a lawn chair or something, just sharing his day with you. That accent, as we talked about, does add an extra layer of flavor and makes it stand out from some of the other stuff going on at the time. My clickbait headline, Brooklyn swagger, British twang, Dana Dane with fame mixed slick beats and wild storytelling to help define 80s hip hop. Like Don said, I don't think that I'd never heard of this, actually. I don't think this is typically considered amongst lay people as being a cornerstone piece, but it definitely is well thought of and influential more within the industry and within the hip hop world, I think. And I was really happy to have a chance to check him out and get to know his kooky personality. So it was a fun listen.
Yeah, he seems like an interesting guy. He's also pretty involved in the fashion world from what I've read. He had a clothing boutique in New York City during the 80s and 90s.
Was it called Paul's Boutique by any chance?
No, it was called Dana Dane's, of course. Okay. I don't know what it was called. He's also an author. In 2009, he released his first novel. So kind of a guy of many talents.
Cool.
But yeah, if you're looking for just kind of a fun storytelling focused hip hop record from this era, I think it could go much worse than Dana Dane with fame.
Before we get to our next pick, while we hear from our friends over at the Getting Down and Wordy podcast.
Riz.
Greetings.
Gendered language.
Onomatopoeias.
The ick.
What makes some words sound funny?
Why just listen to music when you can overanalyze the words in the songs?
Music, language, and Eurovision all crammed into one podcast.
Getting Down and Wordy with Russell and Hannah. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Find us anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
That podcast is dope. Sorry, I got my hip hop.
Boy, yeah, you are just total streets now.
Just spitting left and right here.
All right, let's get to the next one.
All right, my pick for an 80s hip hop album comes from Boogie Down Productions. It's called By All Means Necessary, released in April 1988. It's the second album by the American hip hop group formed in the Bronx in 1986, fronted by KRS-One, born Lawrence Chris Parker in Brooklyn, in 1965. The album is written and produced by KRS-One. It was recorded just months after the murder of their founding member, DJ Scott LaRocque. So KRS-One, you know, after that incident, moved away from the violent themes that had dominated their debut album, Criminal Minded, which Saul mentioned in his top five, and moved in a more socially conscious direction and started using the moniker The Teacher. So let's hear the opening cut. This is My Philosophy.
Where, why, or when will all be explained like instructions to a game. See, I'm not insane. In fact, I'm kind of rational.
So the, you know, the lyrics cover several themes that actually recur throughout the album. So the importance of maintaining hip hop's core values, the role of MCs in safeguarding that culture, critique of the U.S. government, social issues, and a call for peace and an end to violence in black communities. You know, pretty minimalist production, but I feel like for the most part, the beats are pretty hard.
Yeah, they don't have to be much more than they are because his rhymes are great, his delivery is great, and it's engaging just based on KRS-One's delivery and what he's saying. So this is a great time in hip-hop when lyricism, we've talked about it before, was really getting much deeper and better and engaging, and it helped carry, you know, it helped carry those simpler beats that were prevalent in the early 80s.
Yeah, and he really has, a distinct approach. Really enunciates, you know. I mean, you don't miss a word. So just a very distinct flow and cadence. So my clickbait headline for By All Means Necessary is KRS-One shouts from the tip top, stop the violence in hip hop.
Wow!
Wow! Hey.
Yeah,
quite the rhyme scheme there. Yeah.
So KRS-One supposedly viewed himself as kind of a hip-hop Malcolm X. In fact, the cover of the album is an ode to an image of Malcolm X with a rifle. In this case, KRS-One has a Uzi.
But isn't he moving away from violent imagery within hip-hop? That's one thing that confused me about the album cover.
It's just, it's complicated.
Yeah, I think that's a good answer to that.
But yeah, so you know, supposedly he's kind of aiming to inspire action through education and leadership. And so that's that persona of the teacher. And he definitely presents himself as a know-it-all. You know, I mean, he's...
Well, that's part, you know, the confidence is part of the... It's very important for an MC to have.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all... I mean, particularly in this era, you know, is braggadocious a word?
Yes.
It is.
That'd be a good hip-hop name, braggadocious.
There you go.
Anyway, well, let's hear some more. Here's a track called I'm Still Number One.
When I get challenged by a million MCs, I try to tell them we're all in this together. My album was raw because no one would ever think like...
Speaking of braggadocious, I'm Still Number One is a powerful rap anthem that captures the essence of the culture while also asserting the group's prominence in the genre, which is part of the game at the time. It addresses the importance of acknowledging rap's roots and ongoing struggles within the industry and keep moving it forward. The intense lyrics tackle pressing issues of poverty and political corruption. So I think he's basically, this is a time to say, listen up. I know what I'm talking about. I'm the best. Listen to the things I'm telling you. My clickbait headline to describe this album, the ANP is down with BDP. ANP is Album Nerds Podcast.
ANP?
Yeah.
Oh.
By All Means Necessary, a bold lyrical statement that helped define hip-hop for generations to come. Yeah, the social aspects, very important to what hip-hop became, and some of my favorite rap albums, hip-hop albums throughout the 90s and even into today are the ones that tackle life as we know it in our neighborhoods and in America, and those are the most compelling to me, and it's really cool to kind of listen to one of those. It was early in that vein, so yeah, I enjoyed this quite a bit, and I also did notice a little something at the end of this track that he was calling out all the people that are down with them, down with the BDP, and I caught this little tidbit.
Nice. New York City crew, man. Yeah. They all stick together.
I thought that was just, as I was listening to this, I just thought it was cool, and I had not really been too aware of Dana Dane. I loved hearing that shout out to him in that song, so... Just a little bonus.
I need to change what I said about Dana Dane now. He's amazing. I mean, just...
He's got the KRS-One stamp of approval now. So. Yeah, but that's a good point, though, just about the sort of collaborative nature of hip-hop at this time. It did feel a little less confrontational, generally, a little more supportive at the time, would you guys say?
Yeah, especially coastally and certainly city-wise at the time, and probably still somewhat today.
Well, I think after that, you know, the murder of Scott LaRock, you know, I think KRS-One wanted to move away from sort of that rivalry stuff as well. Because, you know, as Saul had mentioned, they had the back and forth with the people from Brooklyn. And I think he's just like, you know, screw that. We got to stick together and stop the violence. All right. Well, let's hear another cut. This is Illegal Business.
Crack is illegal because they cannot stop you. But cocaine is legal if it's owned by a doctor. Everything you do in private is illegal.
Pretty hard-hitting songs there. You know, Don mentioned Stop the Violence, and this is the one following right after Illegal Business. Almost listening to it is kind of like listening to like a lecture, I would say, like a professor would be giving on like maybe some different ideas on, I guess, just methods of control imposed by, you know, governments and different systems where KRS-One is growing up.
I think they would call it a TED Talk or a BDP Talk these days.
Yeah, it's the total TED Talk, yeah. KRS-One talk. My clickbait headline for By All Means Necessary is Professor KRS-One writes a textbook on 80s hip-hop. Yeah, this he's really impressive. I listened to a lot of his solo records that came out in like the early 90s, and they're so freaking dense. And this is dense too, but I found it to be a little bit more digestible than some of his later stuff.
Yeah, he got more and more serious as time went on.
Yeah. This is serious, but there are moments too that are kind of funny, like the track Jimmy, I guess, which is all a song about your Johnson.
Way to use a euphemism for a euphemism. Just say penis.
It's the proper name. Fold it. But largely, this record is pretty serious, I would say. It deals with pretty serious issues, and he gets into some pretty interesting perspectives. So I appreciated that. I also thought it was interesting to hear kind of Islam talked about in a larger sense in a hip-hop record. I'm sure that had been done before, but this was one of the more in-depth discussions on the topic that I can think of in this time period. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, and he incorporates some Jamaican cultural stuff in there as well. Even the Illegal Business, like the chorus of Illegal Business kind of has sort of like a Jamaican vibe to it. I don't know if it was his father or stepfather or something was Jamaican. So, you know, supposedly one of the first records to sort of merge the hip-hop and reggae.
Cool.
Okay, well, I'm, you know, by no means a hip-hop expert, but this one, you know, feels pretty significant to me. So I'm going to nominate Boogie Down Productions By All Means Necessary to the Album Nerds Hall of Fame. So what do you suckers have to say?
Yes, I think so as well. As we talked about, I just think it was laying the foundation for more honest conversations to happen in hip-hop, and I really enjoy that. And there was some innovative stuff, some sampling and things going on here. Yes Slippin' had the Smoke on the Water riff by Deep Purple on it, yeah. Which people were starting to fiddle around with the marriage of rock and roll and hip-hop, and I thought that was nice in there as well. So, yeah, great album.
Yeah, he's probably one of the more talented lyricists, I guess, in terms of like composing like a good thesis in a song and then expanding upon it. It really does feel like a bit of an education. So I can definitely appreciate that. And yeah, I mean, he does a great job. But I mean, even that track I mentioned earlier about the Johnson, it's really about AIDS. I mean, that's the main core of it is focusing on protecting yourself from the AIDS epidemic, which, so yeah, it just bring things back to like the real world and these kind of like harsh truths, which I appreciate.
He keeps it real.
He keeps it real.
Yes.
Way to sum it up, Don.
Wow.
I'll say yes.
Nice. All right. Well, congratulations to KRS-One and the rest of the Boogie Down Productions crew. By All Means Necessary is now a member of the Album Nerds Hall of Fame.
The AMP in full effect.
No diggity.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Time for another deep question by Don. So we're, you know, celebrating some of the good hip hop, you know, that came out of the, you know, that golden age. But what are some of the worst examples of hip hop creeping into mainstream culture?
Oh boy,
there's lots of examples. I think
there are so many to go over here,
particularly in the 80s when rap and hip hop started really taking off, and it got co-opted by advertising agencies and sitcoms and stuff. Yeah. So, yeah.
The commercialization of hip hop happens in any art form, I guess, and it gives them a certain level of popularity. I found a great video that I had come across before of this lady in like her mid-40s, maybe, who's like clearly like a professional dancer, giving like instructional cues for hip hop dancing.
I've seen that.
She's on like this weird soundstage. It's really bizarre, and she's, I have to play a little bit perhaps to really capture the essence.
I think the first thing that you need to know about hip hop, it's all about your posture. This is the first thing I will say to you. You want to do hip hop? You got to stand like this. In a hip hop head, we have this. Boom, bam. Every time.
Something about when you like break down the elements of hip hop into like their individual elements, it really kind of loses all of its magic.
Right. Well, it's about hip hop dance, but trying to define hip hop awkwardly like that is just goofy.
You know, if your hand is like flaccid, it's not hip hop. Right. If you're pointing at something, then it's hip hop or something. And anyway, I mentioned one other quick one here too that just came out just a few months ago. I saw this in the news from this large design company called Canva. They had a corporate event, and they were shamed for this terrible, terrible rap they created to promote their product, which is performed live on stage at their corporate bullshit thing.
But what about me?
Who is you?
A CIO from an enterprise seat, and I have
security. It's a pretty decent rap, but like the overall use of it is atrocious. And I've seen so many of those over the years. I'm sure you guys have too, of those corporate excitement building things.
Who's your audience here, right? I mean, that's just, it's cringy.
It's 2024, man.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
I know.
Yeah.
All right. So, I thought of, there's an episode of Saved by the Bell where the kids are doing a Snow White and the Seven Dorks, and they're all rapping throughout the whole thing. I won't do that to y'all. But I also thought a lot about different commercials. Here's one that came to mind.
It's
right
the
away.
Legend of Zelda, and it's really rad. Those creatures from Ganon are pretty bad. Octorox, Tech Tags, Leavers, too.
The names of the Zelda.
The Zelda characters. Yeah, I mean, and then the wiki woo stuff. I mean, it's terrible. Awesome. Terrible.
Wow.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Awesome. Intense.
Yeah, another commercial like that, the Fruity Pebbles.
Who are you? I'm the master rapper, and I'm here to
There's that.
To get the fruity taste, he's got a trick, Fred.
There's that, and I'm here to say that they always use in these corny raps.
Yeah, that's a red flag for any of these things. Look out.
I was thinking back to one, it was a PSA that just ran constantly like in 1985 or 1986. It was from the New York State Department of Health. So if you grew up in New York State at that time, you've definitely heard this. A PSA called One Dumb Move. 2+2. I'm professor of the rap
and I came to your school because I don't want to see. I've heard this.
Yeah.
One it's like a professor like dancing in the aisles with the kids. Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't the kids like...
The kids Shut are moving up, their like, heads, and the one guy starts breakdancing, and the guy is actually pretty good.
I think that's more of an example of it being of trying to use youth culture effectively, and not it's not a cash in like the Nintendo and and the Fruity Pebbles.
It's a public service.
Yeah. So it's got that going for it.
Yeah, I don't know. At some point, it's like it's kind of cool. It's integrated into the culture, but. Yeah, the corporate side of it does make it feel kind of dirty.
Well, I mean, there's never been a good anti-drug PSA, right? I mean, they're always just cringy.
Oh, no, the egg. This is your brain. This is your brain on drugs. Any questions? That sticks with you.
What about, I learned it from watching you.
That too.
All right. Well, what are some other terrible examples of hip-hop creeping into our culture? Let us know on Instagram and Facebook, or leave a comment on our website, albumnerds.com.
Okay, so I went with Just on the Borderline, an album released in 1989 by the Beastie Boys called Paul's Boutique. Beastie Boys were formed in 1981, American hip-hop rap rock group consisting of Adam, Ad Rock Horowitz, Michael Mike D. Diamond and Adam MCA Yauk, originally emerging from the punk band The Young Aborigines. And then they had some lineup changes and became Hip Hopsters. This is their second album. It pushes some boundaries beyond what they had done on their debut of License to Ill. So why don't we jump in with a little bit of The Sounds of Science.
Constantly on, constantly on, the fountain of youth, not Robotron. This is the word of words before, so...
So they teamed up with the Dust Brothers on production for this album, consisting of Michael Simpson, Easy Mike, and John King, aka King Gizmo. Innovative sample-based music, and they had created all of these tracks, I think with the intention of making an instrumental dance release to play in clubs. But the Beastie Boys thought it was really cool and wanted to rap and write lyrics over it and work with all these hundreds of samples throughout the record. That's what they did to great effect. Didn't do too well commercially at first, though. People were looking for that "you gotta fight for the right to party" frat vibe. That gets to my clickbait headline. From frat party to funky flop, the Beastie Boys' bold follow-up that left fans scratching their heads and opening their minds. So this is a lot to digest. There are at least 105 songs.
You mean like samples or tracks?
Samples.
Yeah.
24 samples on the final track alone. It's since been evaluated as a groundbreaking work that helped redefine hip-hop. And I would agree. I dismissed it at the time because it didn't sound like we're going to fight for the right to party. And it was really, really gutsy to take this on.
Yeah, they were pretty successful with their debut. And this is like a total U-turn.
Yeah.
Which is but it's dangerous to do.
It shaped the sound of hip-hop to come, as well as their own sound. They started to develop what the Beastie Boys really became. Why don't we jump into... song with biblical references. This one's called Shadrach. Going to like CCD and stuff when I was a kid, like those names always stuck with me too. They're fun
what
names.
What's CCD exactly?
It's like a Catholic school thing you go to. It was at night where I grew up, but it was so you could get prepared for First Communion and confirmation stuff.
Bible lessons.
Yeah, a little Bible lessons and junk. It's like Sunday school, but on weeknights.
Okay. Well, Shadrach was the second single off of Paul's Boutique. It does reference the biblical story of Daniel's furnace. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think three guys survived a couple of days in a furnace.
Well, there was... There's. It's in the book of Daniel. There's the story of Daniel in the lion's den, and then there's... Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that yes, they went into this furnace and God protected them, like from the Pharaoh or whatever, put them in there to punish them for not worshiping whatever, not God, something like that. No,
they weren't just cold or something?
No.
The song features a sample from Sly and the Family Stone's Loose Booty, as well as a bunch of other tracks.
Sounds like someone needs some Pepto-Bismol.
Okay. Anyway, my clickbait headline for Paul's Boutique is "The B-Boys create the sound of the future, and all it took was sampling every record ever made." This is kind of like one of those explosions of creativity albums that we've come across a few times on the show. It just feels like kind of like a watershed moment where like burst of creativity. And there's that kind of group, and I guess they were kind of developing into that group that really does feel like they're doing their own thing and are super comfortable in like their own skin. Yeah. And they're not really trying to fit in with the times. And this record does not sound anything like any of the other 80s hip hop records we've talked about so far.
De La Soul did a lot of sampling, but this sounded just more energy filled and frenetic.
Yeah, it just sounds like packed. Like every inch of it has been covered, like a canvas that just completely covered in colors.
In The Sounds of Science, there was back in the USSR, When I'm 64, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band Reprise, and The End from Abbey Road, all mixed in one song.
Crazy.
The drums and the guitars you hear. But they changed speeds on some of this stuff and you know, they did stuff to it as well to make it fit. So
yeah. Yeah, I think like probably one of the weirdest things listening back to the record now, like dude mentioned, doesn't really sound like they're rapping with these tracks. It really sounds like they're just like kind of like yelling over the beats. Mm-hmm. There's no, they don't really fit in with their rhymes at all.
But that kind of became their style, you know?
I guess so, right? I mean, it fits in with like that punk rock vibe mm-hmm. they have going, where it just kind of feels like they don't really, it kind of just feels thrown together a little bit. Even today, after all these years, it's just kind of a stands out record. It just sounds different than anything else.
All right, why don't we move on and listen to a bit of Johnny Royale.
So Johnny Royale tells a story of a fictional homeless man named Johnny Royale, who's they describe as a former rockabilly star who's fallen on hard times. Actually inspired by a real homeless man who hung out near Mike D's apartment, apparently. You know, so they completely make up the rockabilly backstory. But that's fun. And I think that kind of the message of the song is that really anybody can fall on hard times, you know, so don't dismiss these people. Yeah, this song also features many samples. Wind Noise from Pink Floyd's One of These Days.
Wow, you brought up the Pink Floyd.
Gosh, wow. Yeah. Wind Noise? Really? Yeah. That's what it is?
Yep. But also Gene Knight's Mr. Big Stuff, drum beats from Paul McCartney's Mama Miss America, and guitar samples from David Bromberg's Sharon. So yeah, a lot going on every track. My clickbait headline for Paul's Boutique is Beastie Boys and Dust Brothers serve up bouillabaisse of innovative beats in witty wordplay.
Tasty.
So, I mean, we've talked a lot about the sampling, and I think that really is what makes this record innovative. But I do want to say, I mean, the Beastie Boys really are great at what they do. The way they coordinate between the three of them, and even within a phrase, they're taking turns.
They each have a word, you know? It's complicated.
Like a syllable at times.
I don't know how they ever pulled that off live, but they did.
Yeah. But overall, just really, really an amazing record. It might be a little long, but it's there's so much going on, and sonically it's overwhelming. You know, like the other day I was mowing the lawn, and like after when the album finally ended, I'm like, wow, you know, like I was exhausted.
Yeah, a lot happens.
You know, one fun little tidbit that we talked a lot about the samples, but everyone involved is adamant that all the samples were cleared, and apparently it cost $250,000 allegedly, which is nothing compared to today's licensing fees.
Still, that's a lot of money to put up front to make a record.
Yeah,
especially if it's not commercially like successful.
Well, the expectation was that it was going to be huge because they had sold 10 million copies or something of the album before. So, some other highlights. Of course, we got Shake Your Rump, you know, and that's more the fun-loving, party-centric vibe I think that people were looking for, and it's got samples from Afrika Bambaataa, James Brown, and others. There's a lot of information out there on the web. There's a website, actually, called Paul's Boutique Samples and References List, and you can go through each song, see the lyrics, and see what samples they used. It's pretty cool. It's fun.
Yeah, it's kind of fun piecing them together like that, kind of like a reverse jigsaw puzzle. Yeah.
What'd you guys think of B-Boy Bouillabaisse? There was a lot going on in there.
Yeah, I like the bouillabaisse because it's basically like a medley, right? Of just, you know, really short snippets.
Beatles style.
Yeah. So I enjoyed that.
I could see why as Beatles fans, you guys kind of like this record. It does feel kind of Beatles-y in some
ways. There's a lot of Beatles on it.
No, that's true. Yeah.
It feels innovative, studio innovation as the Beatles did. Right? So yeah, it does have some parallels there. So if we're talking on that level, why don't we nominate this bad boy for the Album Nerds Hall of Fame? Good stuff. Changed the trajectory of hip hop, I think, in a lot of ways. The Dust Brothers went on to do some really important other work. They did also produce Mbop by Hanson, but you know, that's what I read. But yeah, this is an incredible record, and I wish I had paid more attention to it at the time.
My next, for me, if I'm being honest, this is probably my least favorite Beastie Boys record. I do appreciate what they were doing on it, and I do enjoy it overall, but it's probably not something I would come back to a whole lot, to be honest. What do you think, Don?
So you're passing and going to me?
I'm very on the fence. I probably shouldn't be.
I don't know what you want. What you want? but this is what I want. So I'm going to say yes. Sorry. I feel like I should be banned for a couple weeks after this episode.
Oh, boy.
I think it's great. All right. I'll say yes, too, because I do think it's an important record.
Oh, welcome, Beastie Boys and Paul's Boutique. Groundbreaking work that redefined what hip-hop could be, and a little genre blurring, which I think is part of what has made newer hip-hop great. So go check out the Beastie Boys, Paul's Boutique.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Well, I've certainly been digging the hip-hop all week. But what about you guys? You digging anything else?
Oh, you know I have been, man. Got a few things in my B-boy pants here. God. not hip-hop at all related, though. Gonna turn the car around in the other direction here. Talk about the Mavericks. They put out an album earlier this year called Moon and Stars. They've been around since the early 90s, I believe, from Miami, Florida. This is their 13th album. Elements of rock, country, folk, and Latin. I think there was even some funk in there. This album is probably the most diverse record I've heard all year, I would say.
Is it a bouillabaisse?
It is a bouillabaisse, man. It's a rich, frothy... Frothy?
Brothy. I don't
know if you want your bass to be frothy.
You want it to be brothy. Yeah,
it's a brothy bass.
That is not what I was expecting.
You guys should listen to that record. It is all over the place. Every track is super high quality.
Okay.
And last one for me is from a Melbourne, Australia jazz fusion group by the name of Mild Life. They had a record called Chorus. It's just a nice, chill, groovy record. It's kind of got some moments of psychedelia, but is largely jazz focused, I would say. I don't know.
Hey, you really were looking to unwind after all the hip-hop, huh?
Yeah, chill out a little bit. What you been digging on down?
Well, I'm not sure I'm digging it, but I'm intrigued by it. So Joe Jonas, right, of the Jonas Brothers. I believe we did their most recent album a while ago. Joe Jonas has a solo record coming out called Music for People Who Believe in Love. But I happened to hear a clip of the single. It's called What This Could Be. Yeah, it doesn't sound like the Jonas Brothers. Intrigued by that clip?
Sort of adult contemporary, so it's got its place. Sure.
Okay. Another one I found interesting, Steve Howe, the guitarist from Yes in Asia, came out with an instrumental album called Guitarscape. Actually, he's got a son, Dylan, on drums. Just kind of his guitar over a lot of kind of
drums,
a weird variety of styles and drums. There's a clip called Touch the Surface.
And so far, we're a lot of mellowing out.
Yeah. I'd like to hear the Beastie Boys rap over that.
They could.
Probably. Sure they could. Wow, Steve Howe's been putting out records since like the 70s. Interesting.
Yep. All right. What are you digging, dude?
I also kind of cooled my heels a little bit here. This is an artist called Hatathli.
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 Okay.
It's spelled Hatathlii.
Is it supposed to be like hot coffee and you burn your tongue so you say it like that?
I don't think so. Wow. The album's called Waiting for a Sign, and Hatathli is a 21-year-old Navajo artist from Window Rock, Arizona, creating music deeply rooted in his heritage. So, hilarious, Don. Blends...
Way to mock their heritage, Don.
I'm the asshole.
Introspective lyricism, lo-fi, indie folk, and subtle 80s influences. Let's check out a little bit of Something's in the Air.
Interesting.
Wow. Getting a lot of... positive buzz out there, and the album, it captures the vastness of the desert landscape and weaves themes of solitude, cultural reflection, and resilience into it. It's atmospheric and haunting, and it's pretty cool. The songs vary somewhat, but I think this kid's got something. It was fun to listen to. So as always, I dig something that I picked up on vinyl. And again, this is more of a curiosity I spotted at the record store. It's by a band called the Splat Cats.
Great name. Love the name.
Called Feeling Bitchy. They're a Buffalo, New York garage/punk rock band from the 80s. They released some albums from 86 to 90. Let's check out a little bit of Even Steven. So this was still fully wrapped. I got it for a couple of bucks. So it had not been opened before I got it. They're on a label called Moving Target, released in 1988. And I just want to mention the names of the band members. On drums, we have Skeeter. On guitar, we have Crank Spector. On piano player, Johnny Lightning. We have Shaggy Faust on lead vocals. So they were, they were goofs. Garage rock revival before its time, I guess. But it's goofy. It's not, I don't know that I love the record, but it's fun to have stupid stuff that you stumble across. So
nice. Well, what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Also on our website, albumnerds.com.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about that time on the show, and I'm reminded of the great American rapper Big Daddy Kane. He said, "If you are what you eat, then feed me dope."
Wow.
Love it. With that in mind, let's bring out my friend and yours, Wadbot, and see what we'll be discovering on next week's episode.
Did he ever hear of edibles?
This is the 80s, man.
Let me stop you right there, Wadbot.
I'm going to let you finish. Sorry.
But there's that crispness in the air. It's fall. It's time for Halloween. So why don't we do a show where we talk about some spooky albums with the Halloween vibe.
Yeah, I'm down for that. Sounds fun.
Cool.
I think Big Daddy Kane would approve.
Right on.
What's your favorite Halloween record? What else are you listening to? Leave a comment on our website or email us at podcast@albumnerds.com. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at Album Nerds. Also, please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app. And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so via PayPal at albumnerds.com/support.
Thank you for joining us on the Album Nerds podcast. We'll catch you next time.
It'd be so scary. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you then.
Alcohol may cause you no alarm until you wake up and find that you are harmed. You may laugh and think cigarettes are a joke, but is it worth bad breath and health to smoke?
No, it's not.
When you check out the score in drug abuse, what you find is the game you can only lose.
It's true.